Fellow Mentors, welcome to our podcast series, Mentorships in Education, brought to you by Just Education at justeducationfirst.com. I am your host, Judy Epstein. I am very excited about the wide range of experts who have volunteered to give up their time and expertise. They will share their innovative ideas, their exciting perspectives, their rich resources, and their research with us. Please continue to delve into these topics on their websites and with your legal counsel, healthcare provider, and education professional. Our guests have information that will be relevant to mentors supporting struggling students, parents, teachers, administrators, legal support, and health professionals. We will address all levels of education with issues that affect academic performance. Our goal is to open discussions and introduce a variety of approaches to those searching for information in a free venue. So, mentors, let me introduce our guests for today. Welcome, mentors, to Mentorships in Education podcast, brought to you by Just Education at justeducationfirst.com. I am your host today, Judy Epstein. Today, we're going to be continuing with our exploration of behavior and behavior remediation, and we have been doing it primarily from the perspective of the student, from a diagnosis or from issues that a child is having psychological perspective. But we're going to do it a little differently today. We have a very special guest who is involved in changing behavior, primarily from a logistics and organizational point of view in the classroom. And so it was with great pleasure that I take a minute now to introduce to you and welcome Julie Wright. Thank you very much, Julie, for being with us today.
Thanks, Judy. Glad to be here.
Before you and I chat, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and talk about your background a little bit, if that's okay with you.
Sure, absolutely.
And tell everybody about what it is that you have done. Julie is a teacher. She's an instructional coach, an educational consultant, and she has over 25 years of experience in rural, suburban, and urban education settings. Julie co-authored a book called What Are You Grouping For? How to Guide Small Groups Based on Readers, Not the Book. And this is one of the things we're going to get into later because Julie very graciously sent me a copy and I have spent the last week delving into it. And I really love it. And I think that it could be so helpful to not just teachers themselves, but to school districts in how to reframe the focus of their teaching in the classrooms. She does blogs for NCTE, and I had to look that up because I didn't know what it was. So it's the National Council for Teacher Education, and also for other education, other organizations. She's currently working on two new books, one about using short texts to fuel reading and writing, and one about the power of planning in her free time. This is very exciting. Not only does she love gardening, but she's a wannabe beekeeper. So cool. That is so cool. Does that mean you don't have any bees yet?
It means I don't have any bees.
Oh.
Just a wannabe, yeah.
Just a wannabe. Maybe you'll just tell me briefly, how did you get involved with bees?
I just have an inquiry around them. I find them fascinating. I read a couple of short books and articles about how bees can really help us sustain things in the environment. And I just caught on fire with me. So, you know, and then the more you start thinking about it and talking about it, you learn there are a lot of people in the world that have those types of interests. So I've learned a lot from friends of mine that share the same interests. So
well, maybe when you get into it, we can work it into a mentor's podcast somehow.
That'd be great. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, I know that you spend a lot of, we've spent a lot of our time addressing parents and students and teachers, you know, in particular. But you do a great deal of your work with school systems and trying to support changes on a broader level. Can you talk a little bit about that and what some of the issues are that you run into and maybe some of the primary concerns that you're asked to address?
Yeah, I think it's, schools today, they're pretty complicated in a good way, I think. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of demands on our plates as educators, but families have a lot of demands as well, and kids too. So I think that one of the biggest obstacles that come with schools today is that time is there's never enough time. Time is never on our side, and so there's a lot of thinking around. You know, the model of schools is outdated. You know, kids don't go to school very many hours, but yet the amount of content and the amount of learning that has to happen is still within those same constructs from a structure from a long time ago. So mm-hmm. for the work that I'm trying to do, it's about maximizing the time that we do have and trying to make the most out of it and making sure that we've named what our high leverage moves can be during the time that we have. So I think that's one thing that comes at teachers and schools and kids. And I think the other thing that happens is there's a lot of, I call it noise. There's mm-hmm. a lot of priorities and a lot of things in the world that kind of come at schools. And that's the same. You know, when I say schools, I could say families. I'm a mom of three kids. Right. I feel it as a parent. And then, of course, that transfers to kids. There's a lot of noise coming at kids.
Right.
What's the most important thing? What am I supposed to be focusing on? And so the ability to be able to sort of clear the noise a little bit and sort of name the things that are most of priority right now. And again, what are those high leverage moves to get where we want to go? And so that's one of the things that I talk a lot with teachers about is to say, if there's that thing that you're going to focus a lot on, what is it going to be? And so when I'm an instructional coach, I'm trying to help shift the way we use our time during learning time. So that's one of my focus areas.
How do you prioritize the time then? When you say shift your focus, that means you're moving away from something that is, am I making an assumption here, something that is on the agenda for kids to learn and moving towards something that you feel is a higher priority? How are you, rationalizing that? How do kids rationalize that? Rationalize that?
That's such a smart question because there isn't one perfect answer, right? So that's when it comes down to figuring that out. Sometimes the mandates are given to us. Sometimes a school district or a state will say, these are the things that count the most. And then it's about figuring out how are we going to put those into good use. And sometimes it's that we have a lot of autonomy to choose and we have trouble clearing the noise ourselves. So I think you're right in saying if we're going to move something to the front burner, what's going to go to the side burner or the back burner? Mm-hmm. And for me, so I'm going to use a very specific example just as a construct, but it's not the only example. For me, it would be talking with schools and classrooms and teams of teachers and even parents in a different context, obviously home, to say if we have 50 minutes of learning time, what does research tell us is going to be the highest leverage move? An old construct would be the lecture-based model to stand in front of kids and talk to them and impart information to them. Mm-hmm. And for some years and years and years ago, that worked for some. I mean, I certainly went to school where teachers talked at me and I seem to have done okay.
Right.
The question becomes, what do kids need today? Could we have been smarter years ago? Should we be smarter about how we use our time today? And so that's the kind of thing that really gets at the heart of making some change. So if you're looking at the 60-minute ELA block or the 60-minute reading chunk of time, and I'm using 60 minutes in across the nation,
right.
It's anywhere from 45 to 120 and everything
right.
in and out of that. If you use 60 minutes and you say, what's going to be your highest leverage move? Research would tell us that the kids, whether they're 5 or whether they're 18, they need to be the one wrestling with the content. They need to be asking questions and doing the reading and the writing work of the work with teachers directing and giving some direct instruction, but not for the whole 60 minutes. So that's for me where the workshop model comes in. The workshop model is the idea of giving kids 2/3 of the learning time to do the work. And the fun part for me is that doesn't mean the teacher's sitting back and doing a whole lot of nothing. It means they're what I call, you know, on roller skates. They are meeting with small groups, meeting one-on-one with kids. And that proximity of getting up close to kids is how you make that high leverage move different. Because, you know, the old model, you sit in front of the class and everyone is facing you. A newer model might be that when someone walks in the room, there's so many different things going on. They're not sure exactly who's doing the teaching, but it should be apparent that everyone in the room is doing some learning.
There, I remember growing up the old model of learning with the child with the top of the head that can open up and the teapot pouring everything in. And that's just an image that has stuck with me. You know, I won't tell you how many decades, but it's hard sometimes to change the structure of what we do when we've been doing it for so long and trying to understand how a new model will work as well. And I'm using quotes here in the air because we don't really know in some cases if it will work because we haven't tried it.
Right. Well, that's why the key, I think, is planning all of it. You know, so if you want to change a construct, you have to be really well planned for it. So you have to imagine what is it that kids will be doing during this 60-minute block of time, and what is it that teachers will be doing, and making a plan around that so that there is confidence that we will maybe make some headway to know that we've reached our goals. And I think the biggest motivator, of course, is that kids are different today than I think they were in the past. And I'm always thankful for that. You know, the world is changing drastically, but I embrace that because I actually think the world is a pretty great place for kids to be interacting with because they have all new paths every single day. And so there is opportunities and they can find their own entry points differently than maybe what when I was a kid. There was kind of a path when I was young. And now there's lots of paths for kids. And I think that's really inspiring. It's also what causes teachers a headache, right? So it can be very scary and it can be very overwhelming because teachers show up every day trying to do some really good work. And if they don't have if there's one path, they can say, well, this is the path we're taking. If there are multiple paths, it's a little bit hard to manage. So I think that's where the support and the guidance comes in.
So let me take this from two directions. You've said that there's a lot of noise coming at teachers, a lot of noise coming at school systems. And so there are a lot of demands coming from multiple areas, multiple directions. And also you're saying, I think, that we have to make conscious choices as to, because we have a finite period of time, we have to make conscious choices as to what our priorities are. We can't say that on our agenda that the kids have to learn multiplication, all their multiplication tables by the first of the year, and know that we only are going to have an hour a day, 4 days a week to do it, and keep throwing this stuff at them because we have to meet our timeline. I think what you're saying is that there are other skills that are involved in this process, and we need to prioritize what it is that we're doing with the kids and have them do it in a way that's more interactive. So I'm going to throw it back to you because you say that, and I love this quote, you have a couple of quotes that I've written down that I like. You say, treat each day's work as an inquiry along the learning journey versus a checklist, as I just said, of what kids need to learn within a finite period of time. So can you give me an example of a teacher, a department, a school system, you know, how whatever level we're dealing with. And I think it would probably be a little scarier if it was just a teacher doing this on their own, because that's making some huge changes. But how would they go about prioritizing some of this learning journey so that it's not just a lot of noise coming at the kids? Yeah.
That's a really fun question. I'll preface it by saying that if we think about the demands, I often share with teachers, the demands are the what. So let's take some basic things like the state standards, which is noise, but it's also guidance. So some people think when I say the word noise, I mean it's a negative. I don't mean it's a negative. I just mean it's stuff that's coming at us that is important to someone. I happen to really love standards. I think standards are smart. They keep us focused. They keep us narrowed into our thinking. What I also love about today's current standards is the standards today, they tell us what, but they do not tell us how. And I'm thankful for that, because the how piece is the really fun piece. And it's, I think, why most teachers get out of bed every day to come to school, to construct and to design, whether they've been able to do it recently or not, that's a whole nother situation. But the idea of that's why they come. But the how is also why kids get out of bed every day. They like the how. So if I think about, I'll think about like a fifth grade classroom. I'm just going to take a classroom in the middle. And I think about the fact that a teacher, because of the what, kids need to read a lot is part of the standards. I'm not using standard language. I'm using just typical language. Uh-huh. You know, standards say if you want to get better at reading, you got to read a lot. So if we're reading a lot, it doesn't tell you, the standards don't tell you what book you have to read.
Right.
And so maybe a fifth grade teacher works together with a team, and they co-design a unit or a mini unit or a learning progression, which is just a content kind of chunked together. And maybe the overarching concept is going to be heroes in our life that we want to grow up to be like someday. So the idea that there's this overarching, beautiful, big topic that has so many opportunities. So during this unit, during that 60 minutes of time, the teacher might share some guided pieces. Like they might read about a few heroes that have inspired them across history. And they might do some shared reading, or they might unpack new vocabulary words for kids, or they might show kids how certain types of books work. And then the goal would be for 2/3 of that 60 minutes that kids go and they get started on their reading to find the heroes in their life that they're interested in becoming someday. But the idea is that while they're doing that work, the teacher is fast at work too. That's when the teacher goes about and pulls small groups and meets one-on-one with kids and really digs in and uncovers the teaching that each group of children or each child needs based on his or her assessment of what's going to move that kiddo forward in the reading. So we go from this, I'm going to do instruction that fits all children the same, to I now have an opportunity during this workshop time to really uncover and meet with kids and use proximity to make a difference.
You just took all my thunder. I'm going to get into your book then, because we've kind of started some of the things that you've just mentioned are in your book that you have co-authored. It's Julie Wright and Barry Hoonan, and it's called What Are You Grouping For? How to Guide Small Groups Based on Readers, Not the Book. And it's focused on grades 3 through 8, but honestly, I've taught a lot of different grades and worked with many different kids in many settings. And while it might be geared for kids 3 through 8, this is a book that preschool, high school, college teachers could all get some ideas from and have to tweak it
you know, to adapt to their population of students they're working with. But you've got some wonderful ideas in here. And I just want to kind of highlight some of the things that I liked, and maybe you can address them more particularly as you feel appropriate. You talk about curating, and that's the only thing that I had to look up to kind of get a definition for, because I didn't find one in there that I felt helped me understand what you were doing in the book. So I have an idea about what it is, but I'm not sure. So maybe you can talk about that. I love the concept of kid watching, when you talk teachers to take the time they have when kids are busy doing their own thing to do kid watching. I love that phrase. You talk about developing individual plans that are relevant to the child in the room, and having children work together and mesh those individual plans. I thought that was great. I like the concept of listening in. Some people feel that might be, you know, inappropriate, but I think that's a great way for us to kind of have a handle on what kids are dominating a conversation and who is understanding the concepts. You kind of alluded to the standards that tell you what to do, but they don't tell you how to do it. And I think it's important for, you know, for you to talk about that in terms of what are some of the suggestions you have in your book. I'm going to get through these quickly because I want you to be able to go over them. One of the things I loved was all the pictures you have in the book. They are so inspiring and so indicative of what a classroom looks like, that is, that where the kids are engaged and curiosity is at its peak. And lastly, I like your templates. I think those would be very helpful to a lot of teachers. But you know what I like best? I love the synopsis that you have in blue. Because I mean, I can read a whole bunch of stuff, and then I can go, as you said, a lot of noise is going on in my head, and the synopsis kind of puts it in a frame for me and helps me to organize, you know, my thoughts and focus maybe what the priorities are. So now I'm going to be quiet, and I'm going to ask you if you would kind of start talking about the book. I also want you to incorporate another quote of yours that I liked, which is change is a process and not an event. And too often as teachers, as parents, we feel that we remediate, we correct behavior, and if they don't do it right away, they know they're not learning anything. We didn't do it right. We've got to try a different way. And we try a different way and we feel we failed because they still didn't do it. And what I forget is that it's all part of the process of their learning. And when they finally get it, it's because of all those things that we did that they learned, not just because of the last thing we happened to throw at them. Yeah. So I like that. But now I'm going to be quiet. I'd like you to kind of address your book and keep that in mind.
Sure, absolutely. Well, thank you for all the kind compliments that you wove in there. I appreciate that so much. This book is interesting because it's a it's kind of a 20 plus year pulled together of practices that worked. You know,
wow.
there's a lot of things that we try with kids, and sometimes they work with one group and not another. And so I feel like this book is kind of the best of the best. It is not to discredit how hard learning can be sometimes, and for everyone, for different reasons. And so I think that I think that's what this book really, the synergy of this book is really about. If anything, to say there isn't one answer. There's not one way. There's not one boxed program. There's not one strategy. The idea is to arm kids and adults alike with a bunch of tools, and couple that hopefully with some engaging, meaningful reasons to show up and do the work, and then get to work. And so I appreciate the notations that you made and that you pulled out of the book, because that they mean a lot to me. So thank you. You know, this book started with this idea of what happens when we lead small groups and we talk too much? You know, there's this notation that's like when you're a teacher and you have a captive audience, whether it's a whole group or a small group or even one child, that you're supposed to be teaching them something. It's a really honorable thing. My co-writer and I, we started thinking about maybe we're doing too much of that yapping away and talking. And so we started studying that. We started asking ourselves, what happens if we just kid watch? And that can be scary to some people because they're like, well, am I not teaching anymore? And you're like, no, of course not. It's a cycle. Mm-hmm. You kid watch enough. So kid watching to us, it's actually an older term coined back in the 1990s.
Really?
It's an early literacy structure. And so we just revolutionized it by calling it Kid Watching 2.0. And Yetta Goodman and Gretchen Owocki, they were studying early literacy pieces, and they were only focused on, and I don't mean only, but they were super focused on early literacy behaviors of kids. And my co-writer and I, we studied them many decades ago. And we went back, you know, we said, what's the one thing we always go back to? We always go back to studying kids, even if we're working in older classrooms. We're not studying the same stuff, but we're studying. So we started kid watching, and we started to notice what kids could and couldn't do. And when where's the sweet spot of listening in before you join in? What happens when kids are taught how to host their own small groups?
Oh, that's so cool. I like that.
So that we can change the structure. So historically, I'm going to go with the elementary classroom because unfortunately in middle school, this is an overgeneralization. small groups don't happen as much in the secondary as they do in elementary. So in your elementary classroom, there's a thing called guided reading, and it happens usually in K-2 classrooms. It's a very structured protocol. And then after kids kind of move forward past guided reading, the sort of the phenomenon for my co-writer and I is that people just stop doing small groups. Or if they start doing small groups, it's because kids are needing intervention. And the idea of small group work is that the closer we get to the work of kids, the more proximity we have, the more we have a chance to impact it. So we spent a lot of time hosting small groups for all kinds of kids, every child in our inner circle, and to say small groups are good for everyone for lots of different reasons. And the thing that we found is when we kid watched, we learned things that we didn't know kids could do, and we learned things that we thought kids could do that they really couldn't. And so it opened up a whole new inquiry for us. So the kid watching piece is about, for lack of a better word, sizing up what you think you know, developing theories about kids and their learning, and then deciding how you're going to impact that theory next. Everything from the kiddo who needs major intervention for whatever reason to kids who could teach the class and don't have the opportunity to do so. That kind of thing.
You say, and I'm going to let you continue, but while you're saying here, teachers, you know, go in the classroom and try things and find out things that you didn't know before, whether what kids know or what they don't know. You say it's important for teachers to take some risks in the classroom and to try it. They're not failures if it doesn't work. You say they need to learn to pivot. I love that concept of be ready to kind of go in a different direction if something doesn't work. Right. And you say that with so many, with such clarity and with so many examples in your book. And you talk about guided reading. I would imagine, I've never used guided reading, I'm more working with kids that are older, but I would imagine that guided reading is a bit of a strain for some kids in the classroom, maybe who aren't good readers or who can't sit long enough. And so while most of the class is on target and on focus. There are some kids who perhaps aren't as engaged. And by taking a chance and doing something a little bit differently after that guided reading session, maybe you'll bring some of those other kids in to the process.
Yeah. So, guided reading is a structure that has worked for a lot of kids because it takes into account a lot of teacher modeling and some independent practice and some word study. The interesting part about it is that, you know, just because kids may have moved toward more independence with their reading, it's of my belief and my co-writer's belief that kids still need small group instruction. And so this is a way to get at small group instruction in a real meaningful way. The other interesting part about it is a lot of guided reading focuses on leveled texts. So it puts kids, for good reason, it puts kids in an instructional level or an independent level and gives them access to those texts. The one thing my co-author and I, we found when we studied, we learned that one of the things that we learned was when kids are excited about the book that they're reading and excited about the topic they're reading about and excited about the social capital that comes with working in a group, the level tends to mean a little bit less. So for example, if you have a fourth grade child who is really interested in a particular type of animal, and you have a pretty hard text. You have a New York Times article that is a little above what they might be able to access. Research tells us that if you're that child and you read multiple things about that animal and you dive into that a little deeply, that you are going to be able to read that harder article eventually and a lot faster than you might maybe think you could. So I think that's the other difference when you're leaning in and you're kid watching and you're also deciding maybe it's time to join in that group. You know, you're not just always sitting on the outside of the circle. You're also joining in. So let's go back to that heroes. Who are the heroes that you want to be? Let's imagine that you have four or five different small groups around the classroom working on different, one group is doing, you know, heroes from a long time ago. One group is doing heroes that would be considered inventors. Another one is women heroes in our world today. You know, whatever that construct is, based on kids' interests. Each group would then have tons and tons and tons of eyes on print, reading, 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 eyes on print, which is what research tells us is what builds readers. The idea would be that as a teacher, you might strategically go ahead and join specific groups for very specific reasons. Maybe teach them something or help them uncover vocabulary or actually offer them a new piece of text with some guidance. But that other groups are still meeting without you. And that's the difference. You know, the difference is usually it's that kids are all reading silently and a teacher is meeting with one group and kids rotate through and you kind of wait for your turn with the teacher. And in this case, you become as significant as everyone else in the room, meaning the child. And we have found that really good things happen, especially when kids start to, what you mentioned, curate. When kids start to curate, so I might meet with a small group who is diving into, you know, heroes from a long time ago. And so I might say to that group, tonight, go home and survey your parents and say, or anyone at home and say, who are the heroes that you remember from when you were little, who were inventors? And they might jot those things down. So the next day, our goal might be to find two or three pieces of text, whether it's at the library or online, that resemble what our families said were their heroes. So now all of a sudden, we're all curators of new text for us to read. It might be that we can read that, or it might be that we have to read that. We could make that decision as a group. But that would be one way for us to be able to think about curating. And then the beauty of that is if I'm a child and I now have this two pocket folder or this bucket of new texts around all this stuff, I'm never going to be without reading materials. And as a teacher, I can start to develop individual reading plans based on that. I can meet one-on-one with children or with small groups. And I think that piece is the piece that gets teachers really excited.
So when you say curator, in terms of the kids, are you talking about the kids becoming an investigator and bringing information together that they're interested? Is that how you're using it? Yeah. Like a museum curator?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. And it's really fun. So it's two parts, right? It's that teachers can curate texts for kids.
So in another sense, teachers can accumulate yes. a library of texts as a curator yeah. would.
Okay. That's right. And then once kids are involved, you could say, you know, Judy, I use myself as an example.
Yeah.
If you and I are in a small group together mm-hmm. you say, oh, well, Julie is super interested in bees. So if you see anything about bees, make sure you grab that for her. That's how people become curators of other people's content, right?
Okay.
That they're interested in.
I was having difficulty seeing how that was going to work. Okay.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Great.
Yeah.
That's great. You kind of talked, just your enthusiasm is contagious. And so you've talked a little bit about, you know, passion being necessary and curiosity being necessary and having the kids and the teacher swimming in topics that they're very interested in. You also mentioned that you're not opposed to Common Core. You think it's important, but it tells you the what and not the how, and you have addressed the issue that the how is still open to negotiation, so to speak. So one of the tools, I'm guessing, that you like to use is thinking partners. Is that correct?
That is, yeah. That's correct.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of times in classrooms, one of the biggest concerns of teachers, I understand it, I was a classroom teacher for many years, is you worry about when you, one of the reasons teachers tend to hold kids sort of what I call at bay, where they use more of the lecture model, is because the moment that you release them, there is room for havoc, right? There's room for misbehavior. There's room for management problems, those kind of things.
Oh, yes.
And that's a real thing for teachers. So we know we're smarter than we were two decades ago. We know that a huge amount of children's behavior can be tied to motivation and engagement. That is not to say that is the only thing that is accounted for. But we know that when kids get jazzed up about what it is that they're learning about, or their purpose for learning, or an audience that they're making something for, we know that their engagement sort of starts to skyrocket. So the same holds true for texts and for the things we put in front of kids to read about and to write about. Well, it's really hard. Once you start to release kids, it's really hard to get it. Like if you stand back, if you're the teacher and you're like, oh, now what? One management tool is to make sure that everyone in the classroom has a thinking partner. And those thinking partners can be for different reasons. So we might set up some thinking partners for keeping each other, making sure that we have text to read. So we might be curation thinking partners where we make...
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, that we always have something to read. And if I'm without something to read, then I'm going to go to my thinking partner and say, I need some help. We could have thinking partners related to when I get stuck on a bunch of words in something I'm reading and I need some help, the first thing I should be thinking about is who can help me? What are my strategies? So I might have, you know, an unpacking words thinking partner. I might also have a reading to someone else thinking partner. I mean, whatever you can imagine kids working on, you can imagine setting up a thinking partnership. And a thinking partner could be literally two children, or it could be a trio. You could have a thinking partnership group. The key is to not have 1,000 of those going on at once. It's to think about what's your goal, what are you trying to get kids to do, and it allows kids to not only become in charge, but also have such value in the classroom, which they ultimately hold anyways. I mean, we show up every day for them anyways. So why not make sure they know how valuable they are, but also what happens to kids when they get to teach someone or help someone or show someone. It also sets this classroom culture that we're all good at something and we all need to get better at something. So why not have peers or classmates to do it with? That's the idea.
So give me a visual of the classroom. I'm in my classroom. Susie and Billy are thinking partners. Would everybody in the room at that point have a thinking partner? Or would maybe some kids, maybe three or four kids be involved at a station where they're doing math, or somebody else be doing reading? Or is it thinking partner time, or is it integrated with other activities?
Those are all really good questions, and all of those answers are completely accurate. So when I'm working with a teacher, I'll say to them, let's try on thinking partnerships. And let's have everybody do it at the same time so we can learn the routine of it, right? Okay. So let's have everyone get a thinking partner around making sure that we always have text to read. Let's make it real simple and make it real fun and enjoyable. And then let's make sure that kids know how that kind of thinking partnership works. And then we're going to practice that a little bit. And we might even practice it at the same exact time. And then we might reflect on what did that feel like? How did that go? And then the most important thing we would say is, okay, so we're not going to schedule thinking partner time, partnership time about texts once a week, because what if you don't need a thinking partner then? So how would that look if next Thursday you are sitting in front of you and you have nothing to read, what would you do? And so they would say, well, it's time for me to get my thinking partner and have them help me. So really what we're doing is we're creating like sort of like these lifeline life skills to say, you know, what do I do as an adult? So I'll say to kids all the time, when I'm without something to read, what do I do? Who are my thinking partners? Sometimes
so
I go
is,
on
that, is yeah. that a self-help strategy that you
Absolutely.
Encourage?
Absolutely. What kids don't realize is they don't realize it's a self-help strategy because they're doing it with someone. So they don't realize. So you have to label it for kids sometimes. You have to, once they get good at it, you have to say, do you, and the way that I do it is I explain how that happens in my adult life. So do you know what I'll say? Do you know what Mrs. Wright does? You know, me, Mrs. Wright, you know what I do when I need blah, 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 blah. And then I'll fill in the blank for them so that they start to see that we really are our own advocates for anything that we need when it comes to our own learning, that self-directedness, and that there's no shame in reaching out for help, because the world is more fun when you have help doing it anyway. So those kinds of thinking partnerships.
What would be another example of a self-help strategy? As it pertains to some of the things that you just talked about, what would you label as a self-help strategy?
Yeah, I think for kids, we talked about that 60-minute block of time, right?
Uh-huh.
So I encourage teachers and kids. So let's say you've taught a little 8-minute direct mini lesson to the whole class, and you've said, this is what we're going to be working on, and this is how this goes, and I've showed you a model of that. And I'll say to kids, you know, right now, if you're ready to go get working, go. If you're not ready, stay here. Come get another dose of whatever it is that you think you need. Or if you're someone that you don't really need me as a teacher, but you know you need a partner for a little bit to get started, then go find what you need. So that idea of saying, sometimes I need to advocate for what I think I need, because the realness of it is sometimes kids don't always understand because they don't understand. Sometimes they don't understand because they're thinking about something else. Sometimes they don't understand because they're actually still thinking about something that you or someone else said 20 minutes ago. Or sometimes they're not totally focused in because they're actually anticipating something that's about to happen. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's life. And so I'll say to kids, you know, it doesn't, like, I'm not upset with you if you're not sure what to do. Like, what are you going to do about it?
Like, that's what you're actually making them be, I know as we say in the lingo, be more metacognitive, but you're teaching them to reflect a little bit about what happened, what the outcome was of what they did, why it happened that way, what can they do it better the next time. And there's your process that you're talking about, you know, in developing success, it is a process. And how many times do you need to do that process to teach them to go through in their own minds, you know, I didn't do a good job with reading class yesterday. Maybe I should take more time to go over the vocabulary words before I jump into the book. Maybe I do need to stay with Miss Wright a little bit longer. That kind of out loud talking that you do to them makes them a little more aware of what it is that they might need to be a better advocate for themselves when they go into some of this stuff.
I just was smiling because I think that that's exactly, I mean, that's the kind of environment, you know, I always think every day in school is dress rehearsal for what life is going to hold for us, right? I mean, time is so precious. It's dress rehearsal. So whatever we hope that they, however we want kids or our hopes and dreams for them to function in the world 10 or 15 years from now, depending on how old they are, is what we should try to be dress rehearsing as much as possible. And so for me, having kids know that from a young age, they are in charge of their own journeys, literacy, math, whatever it is so very important to me. That doesn't mean that being in charge means you don't need any support. It doesn't mean that teachers aren't super important. That's not it at all. It's that they are important. So one of the, I think the other sort of self-help strategies that is a little bit of a different way of thinking is, if I'm working with a teacher or a group of kids and we're into this, like, who are our heroes, I might say to kids, so we're going to be doing all this learning. What are we going to do with the stuff we learned? And we'll start brainstorming ways we can put our new knowledge into the world. And kids come up with the most amazing ideas. It's just, you know, it's amazing to me that we think we need to be so involved, because they come up with great strategies and great things that, and you always know what matters to them because they bring up things that make a difference. And so my goal as a teacher at that moment is to continue to kid watch, to listen into what they're saying, think about what they're trying to have me think about, so that when they have a purpose for all of this work that they're doing, so that they have a real audience and a real world purpose, because that becomes their own motivation and their own advocacy for what that might look like. So an example might be a group of kids were just studying some heroes, which is what made me think of that last spring. And they said, we have learned so much about people we didn't even know were heroes. We think other people need to hear about that. And so this happened to be fifth grade group of kids.
Yeah.
We started talking about, it was like we became party planners for shouting out the heroes in the world that may have been missed. You know, this whole idea of like, who isn't on our radar that we really should know about? And so it became this really beautiful way of kids. So no one was doing anything to kids and nobody was giving them a test. They assessed themselves by ending up hosting, you know, like a family hero night. And you had an amazing display of kids figuring out how they wanted to talk out what they had learned, make videos about what they had learned, make little picture books about what they had learned. And so across the learning community, it didn't all look the same, but it was a beautiful display of learning. And so I think that in and of itself is a self-help strategy, even though it's a little different in way of thinking about it.
I want to just make two points to this wonderful advice that you have given us. Number one is kids are learning to take responsibility for their own choices. They can't point a finger at anybody and say it was his fault. I didn't learn it because we worked in a group. It was your fault because you didn't teach it to me. It was the book's fault because I couldn't read it. You're giving them the tools to think about what it is that they need and to learn to state what it is that they need so that they can take charge of their own learning process in many ways. And I think another point that you didn't come out and say specifically, but you have to me at other times when we've spoken, I want to say that you're encouraging teachers to, even if they're not familiar with all of the different aspects of the things that you're suggesting, that they can try one thing that they're comfortable with and see if it works in their classroom. And if it doesn't, then again, you know, pivot to something else. But change isn't made unless you take that first step and start wherever you're comfortable with. I'm assuming you would agree with that.
100%. Absolutely. You know, I call it taking one bite of the elephant, right?
Like, oh my gosh.
what's the one bite of the elephant you want to, yeah. What's the thing you want to take? You know, what's that thing you're going to just try to null on and say, you know, and this is the other funny thing is I do say pivot all the time, but I have a step in between sometimes. So I'll be working with a group of kids or teachers and something will not have worked. And I'll say, you know what? Time out. This, like, we took a bite today. We went this direction.
Right.
It doesn't feel like it's working. Can we name what we think kind of is working and what is not
awesome.
Working, right? Like, can we name it? And sometimes kids are funny. They're like, well, we shouldn't give up on this. We should just try again tomorrow. And you're like, okay, so our pivot is really just a little sidestep to try again. Or kids will name it, or teachers will say, that just didn't feel right to me, that didn't whatever. And then we can go ahead and revise a plan based on that. And instead of thinking something was a failure, just to say, well, it's part of the process, right? We decided that move wasn't what everyone needed right then and there. So let's move in a different direction.
I can't believe how fast our time has gone. And I there's one other thing that I want you to kind of consolidate for me before we kind of close off here. If you were to give parents and or teachers some guidance in what they're doing at home and trying to change behavior, you know, with their kids at home without being confrontational, but eliciting some choices, changes, can you extrapolate some of the things that you do in the classroom and give some parents some suggestions?
Boy, do we have another hour for that one?
Can you bullet point a couple of things and then they can read your book?
Of course. No, of course. No, that's great. I think that one of the biggest lessons I've learned across several decades of work is that, you know, when kids, and we could put adults in this bucket too, you know, behavior is just a form of communication. So when we have an outpour of some type of communication that looks like behavior, we have some responsibilities to sort of push the pause button. And instead of jumping in and making our own assumptions about what that is or what we think is happening, and which is where we sort of end up playing the blame game and we sort of, you know, make our own, we put our own assumptions to the test, we can just push the pause button and ask, you know, like, what do you need? What am I seeing that you need me to hear? So that people all have a voice. So especially little people in our lives, to be able to say, for the most part, the majority, and I mean the majority, people show up to do good things. Teachers show up to do good work for kids. Kids show up to do good work for school. They show up. So our job is to figure out what they're trying to tell us when there's a behavior. For teachers, it's about starting where you're comfortable, taking one bite like we've talked about. And for, I think for parents is to know that any good response or any good intervention is just really good instruction. I don't know how else to say it. Mm-hmm. The best intervention for anything is just really, really good instruction, good modeling, good talking out loud, good metacognition, good figuring out what kids need, and then figuring out how to make that happen, either for themselves or helping kids figure out how to help it for themselves. So I think that's a mouthful. That's probably more than you asked for. That's more than a nibble. But I do think that the idea that when people show up to do good work, good things happen is a huge piece of the work.
That's great. I have so thoroughly enjoyed our discussion. I enjoyed your book. What are you grouping for? How to Guide Small Groups Based on Readers, Not the Book. It's kind of focused on grades 3 through 8, but I will say again, it is easily adaptable to any kids at any level because some of the ideas and concepts are universal. Written by Julie Wright and her co-author, Barry Hoonan. Julie, if people want to get in touch with you, if they have any questions, how can they do that?
Yeah, they can feel free to reach out to my website, which is juliewrightconsulting.com, or my email, which is a little lengthy. It's Julie T, like the letter T as in Tom, Wright 4444@gmail.com.
I want to thank our guest today, Julie Wright, and all those who have helped make the podcast possible. Thank you, mentors, for joining us. Please go to justeducationfirst.com and subscribe so you won't miss out on any of our future topics and our guests. I want you to look over some of the podcasts as well because there may be some topics there that you're interested in or even some guests whose names you recognize. You can go to Buzzsprout and find us on YouTube as well as iTunes and Spotify. We have some guests coming up who I think will surprise you, a great mini-series of topics that include autism and gifted students and ADHD, you name the alphabet, and we're going to be addressing it over the next 3 or 4 months. If you have any suggestions for guests or for topics, please get in touch through the website. Thank you again, and have a very special day. Thank you, mentors, for being with us today. If you found this podcast of value, please visit justeducationfirst.com to subscribe to our blog and mentorship and education podcast so that you may continue the exploration with us. Our goal is to provide a free treasury of information for our listeners so they can become acquainted with the amazing resources that we have available to us. We want to thank all of our guests for giving their time and sharing their wealth of information with us. Please also visit their websites and explore more of their resources to further your pursuit of the topic. Hope to hear from you at justeducationfirst.com. Have a good week, and thank you.